This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with The Week magazine of January 16th. Trump claims control of Venezuela after U.S. raid. Confusion reigned in Venezuela after the U.S. toppled President Nicolas Maduro in a lightning military operation, with President Trump saying the U.S. would now run the country, while the remaining leaders of the autocratic regime insisted they were in charge. Trump gave no details of how the nation of 28 million would be governed following an early morning raid that seized Maduro and brought him and his wife Celia Flores to New York City to stand trial on narco-terrorism charges. But Trump asserted, "We're going to run it, fix it." Elections, he said, would be held at the right time. Trump demanded total access to Venezuela's vast oil reserves and announced the interim government would give the U.S. up to 50 billion barrels of oil. Revenues from its sale will be controlled by me, he said, and used to benefit the people of Venezuela and the United States. Secretary of State Marco Rubio contradicted Trump, saying the U.S. was not running Venezuela, but would instead keep a military quarantine in place to coerce the government. Maduro's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, was sworn in as interim president and struck a defiant tone after the U.S. raid, which killed at least 80 people, including military personnel and civilians, according to Venezuelan officials. Rodriguez called it an atrocity and insisted Venezuela would not be a colony to any empire. After Trump warned she would pay a very big price if she doesn't do what's right, Rodriguez struck a more conciliatory note, calling for peace and dialogue. Exiled opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, winner of last year's Nobel Peace Prize, said she was ready to assume control and would win a popular vote in a landslide. But Trump said she lacked the country's respect and that it would be very tough for her to be the leader. World leaders and Democrats on Capitol Hill assailed Maduro's seizure. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called it illegal and a dangerous precedent. Representative Seth Moulton, Democrat of Massachusetts, said the reckless elective regime change operation was not authorized by Congress. Trump dismissed his critics as weak, stupid people and hinted at military action in Mexico, Cuba, and Colombia, and a U.S. takeover of Greenland. American dominance in the Western Hemisphere, he said, will never be questioned again. Trump's attack on Venezuela was illegal and unwise, said the New York Times. Few will miss Maduro, a despot who rigged elections, tortured and killed dissidents, and immiserated his country since taking charge in 2013. But Trump has offered not even a fig leaf of legal authority for this act of war, nor a coherent rationale besides the ludicrous claim that Maduro ran a narco-terrorist regime. And if there's an overriding lesson of American foreign affairs in recent decades, it's that toppling even the most deplorable regime can make things worse. This military masterstroke was an act of hemispheric hygiene, said the Wall Street Journal. An ally of Russia, China, and Iran, Maduro spread mayhem far and wide. That justifies the action under international law, and the Constitution gives the president broad leeway to act to protect national security, allowing him to reasonably sidestep congressional approval. But the stakes are high for what comes next. Whether he owns up to it or not, Trump is now in the business of regime change that he'll have to make a success. Under what authority can Trump attack a foreign country that has not threatened us? Asked Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. Even if you grant the dubious proposition that it's within his constitutional power, Trump needed to go to Congress for prudential reasons to make his case for why this serves America, set our clear goals, and offer a rational plan for achieving them. But it's not clear Trump actually has a plan, because if he did, there's no good reason why he'd remove Maduro but leave behind his anti-American Marxist regime. Trump may have been guided by a confidential CIA assessment, said Michael Wilner in the Los Angeles Times. It warned of a wider conflict requiring U.S. boots on the ground if he were to back Venezuela's democratic opposition. It judged that neither Machado nor Edmundo González Urrutia, the opposition candidate who rightfully won the 2024 election, would be able to command Venezuela's armed forces, which are controlled by Maduro loyalists. Trump's tentative backing leaves Rodriguez walking a tightrope, said Joe Daniels in the Financial Times. The canny political operator must balance the need to assuage Trump with the need to placate domestic audiences. The real power in Venezuela is neither Trump nor Rodriguez, said Ryan Dubay in the Wall Street Journal. It's two men who command people with guns. That's Interior Minister Diosdado Cabello and Defense Minister Vladimir Padrino, who lead the police, military, and militias that kept Maduro in power with deadly crackdowns on dissent. For now, they are displaying unity, said Rodriguez, but they represent a wild card for Trump's bet that the remnants of the regime will fall in line to avoid Maduro's fate. This is a sad moment for America, said Mona Charin in the Bulwark. Not every U.S. military adventure has been noble, but no country has more often extended itself for good purposes around the globe. But our intervention in Venezuela has nothing to do with promoting democracy. It's about straight-up plunder. Trump is turning the U.S. into an outlaw nation that threatens neighbors, bullies allies, and kidnaps foreign leaders, exactly the kind of country against which America used to defend others. Trump pushes plan to annex Greenland. An emboldened President Trump threatened to take over Greenland, saying that the U.S. absolutely needs the semi-autonomous Danish territory for national security purposes, prompting Denmark to warn that such an annexation would destroy NATO. Trump said Denmark lacked the ability to defend the vast resource-rich island from Russian and Chinese activity in the Arctic. You know what Denmark did recently to boost up security in Greenland, he said. They added one more dog sled. Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen said her government was taking Trump's threat seriously. If the U.S. were to attack a NATO ally, everything would come to an end, she said. The international community as we know it, democratic rules of the game, NATO, the world's strongest defensive alliance, all of that would collapse. Secretary of State Marco Rubio insisted the U.S. intended to buy, not conquer, Greenland, and said he would visit Denmark to discuss a possible purchase. But Caroline Leavitt, Trump's press secretary, refused to rule out military action, saying it's always an option at the commander-in-chief's disposal, and Katie Miller, wife of Trump advisor Stephen Miller, posted a map on social media last week showing Greenland painted with the U.S. flag and captioned, "Soon." Republican defense hawks urged the administration to drop the whole idea. Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, said seizing the territory would be a catastrophic act of strategic self-harm to America and its global influence. Denmark is right to take Trump at his word, said Mark Champion in Bloomberg. The president recently appointed Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry as envoy to Greenland, a signal he wants to make his own Louisiana purchase, and he's certainly willing to use force if necessary. Trump won't be persuaded by moral arguments about international law, the value of NATO, or the fact that he'd be acting against the democratic will of Greenland's roughly 57,000 people. Unfortunately for the Danes and for Europe writ large, they hold few cards to play in Trump's world of might makes right. Even if Trump chose to buy rather than invade, the acquisition would be a headache, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com. It would require an act of Congress, EU ratification, and complex negotiations and treaty arrangements. Then there's the actual cost. Would U.S. lawmakers fork out hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars on the president's whim when their constituents are struggling to pay for health care, housing, and groceries? Yet Trump's strategic instincts are correct, said the Wall Street Journal. The U.S. does need to hedge against future Russian and Chinese inroads in Greenland, which hosts U.S. missile defense radar, sits by vital submarine lanes, and has reserves of rare earths. But the U.S. already has a free hand there under a 1951 treaty with Denmark, so why take the land? Working with its ally would be far better for U.S. interests than grabbing a new territory. Protests in Iran could prompt U.S. intervention. The death toll mounted in Iran as the regime used live fire to try to put down the most widespread protests in years, despite President Trump's threat to intervene if demonstrators were killed. At least three dozen Iranians have been killed in the protests, which began last month among shopkeepers in Tehran angry over the deep devaluation of the currency, and have since spread across the country. The rial has lost half its value in the past year, and the price of cooking oil tripled in just the past week. Crowds chanted, "Death to the dictator," and "Neither Gaza nor Lebanon, my life for Iran," a reference to the Islamic Republic's support for Hamas and Hezbollah. Security forces responded with tear gas and live ammunition, even storming a hospital where injured protesters were being treated. Seeking to mollify the protesters, the government announced a new cash subsidy of 10 million rials, about $7, a month per household. Iran's economy has suffered from U.S.-led sanctions over its nuclear program, as well as a prolonged drought that has dried up Tehran's water supply. U.S. and Israeli airstrikes last year took out the country's air defenses, and in their meeting last week, President Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said they would attack again if Tehran continued to rearm. In a late-night Truth Social post, Trump said that if Iran killed any protesters, the U.S. was locked and loaded to come to their rescue. Iran's military chief, General Amir Hatami, responded, "We will cut off the hand of any aggressor." The deep, unresolved rupture between the Iranian state and society is widening, said Saeed Golkar and Jason M. Brodsky in Foreign Policy. Mass protests have erupted several times over the past decade, most notably the Woman Life Freedom rallies that began in 2022. These protests, though, involve a broader swath of Iranian society, including merchants, students, truckers, and bus drivers far from the major cities. The center of gravity has moved toward regime change rather than social reform. "Nothing would be better for that nation," said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic, "but the U.S. is not ready for a war of national liberation in Iran." Of course, Trump probably doesn't have any intention of following through on his irresponsible nocturnal ravings on social media. That would plunge the U.S. into another misbegotten Middle East adventure. But his words could lead to serious miscalculations by desperate people in Iran who think the U.S. president has their backs. Indeed, Every previous protest movement was ruthlessly crushed, said Noah Rothman in National Review. Yet this time, Iran's leaders seem spooked. Last year's U.S. and Israeli airstrikes left Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei weaker, both mentally and physically, and the mullahs are reportedly considering decamping to Moscow if the military turns against them. Maybe these riots turn out like all the rest, or perhaps this time really is different. Venezuela, the Donroe Doctrine takes shape. President Trump used to offer only vague answers when asked to explain the U.S. military campaign against Venezuela, said The Economist in an editorial. He'd cite the need to stop drugs or to reclaim oil assets. Rarely, if ever, did he mention regime change. But after last week's stunning pre-dawn raid that captured President Nicolas Maduro, Trump laid out an extraordinary view of the use of American power, saying he would impose American dominance over the entire Western Hemisphere. Under the muscular revival of the 1823 Monroe Doctrine, now the Donroe Doctrine, all countries from Canada to Argentina will yield to Washington. Venezuela will sell oil on terms set by the U.S. Cuba's leftist regime will be replaced. Troops could be deployed against the cartels running Mexico, Trump said, while Colombian President Gustavo Petro will have to watch his ass. And Greenland, part of NATO ally Denmark, could be seized. This abrupt return to a spheres of influence model of geopolitics is a death blow to the law-based humanistic world order, said M. Gessen in the New York Times, and a gift for Russia and China. By declaring his right to invade and plunder America's neighbors, Trump has greenlit Chinese leader Xi Jinping to seize Taiwan and Russia's Vladimir Putin to take as much of Europe as he wants to bite off. Trump likes slapping his name on things, said Rich Lowry in National Review, but the Donroe Doctrine just rearticulates a principle that has guided our foreign policy for 200 years. The 20th century alone was littered with examples of the U.S. using its military dominance to advance its interests in Latin America, from Teddy Roosevelt's grabby maneuvering to secure the territory for the Panama Canal, to the 1989 raid ordered by George H.W. Bush that captured Panama's Manuel Noriega. Trump's rhetoric is more blatantly self-interested than we're used to, but there is a long and sensible American tradition of our policing and controlling our own geographical backyard. Rhetoric matters, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark. Yes, at certain moments, the U.S. has acted without regard for international law or respect for smaller nations' sovereignty. But if the U.S.-led world order that emerged after World War II stands for anything, it's a belief in those moral precepts and in the system of international rules that was built upon them. That Trump justified the Maduro raid purely in terms of American self-interest and seems more interested in extracting loot than spreading democracy confirms that we now live in a world, as Trump advisor Stephen Miller bragged to CNN this week, that is governed by strength, that is governed by force, that is governed by power. It was always going to end this way, said Nick Catoggio in the Dispatch. Some critics are wasting their breath on the hypocrisy of our supposedly isolationist president embracing overseas adventures. But expansionism is baked into the cake of authoritarian movements, where the obsession with dominance always eventually requires demonstrations of greatness at other countries' expense. as his poll numbers slide, the Epstein scandal festers, and the midterms draw closer, the allure to Trump of more military conquests will only grow, said Edward Luce in the Financial Times. And few would be splashier or easier than seizing Greenland. Anyone who thinks Trump is merely trolling with his renewed fixation on Arctic real estate should go book a holiday in Caracas. Only in America. Texas A&M University has ordered a philosophy professor to stop teaching Plato. The school recently banned academic courses that advocate race or gender ideology. After reviewing the syllabus for Professor Martin Peterson's Contemporary Moral Problems course, officials instructed him to remove two passages from Plato's Symposium, written around 380 BC, discussing the origins of human sexuality, and gave him 24 hours to confirm his willingness to mitigate your course content. McDonald's has been hit with a class action lawsuit that claims the fast food giant deceptively markets the McRib, which despite its name does not contain any actual pork rib meat. In a statement, McDonald's insisted the fan favorite McRib sandwich is made with 100% pork and vowed to challenge the plaintiff's inaccurate allegations that the patty includes ground up lower grade heart, tripe, and scalded stomach. It was a good week for product placement after Nike sold out of a gray $260 sweatsuit within hours of President Trump sharing a photo online of a handcuffed and blindfolded Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro wearing the fleece-lined athletic gear during his transport to the U.S. It was a good week for productivity after President Trump unleashed a salvo of 89 social media posts between 12:45 a.m. and 1:40 a.m. on a Sunday night. Averaging one post every 37 seconds, Trump's fusillade touched on such topics as Somali daycare fraud, the stolen 2020 election, and Barack Obama's ineligibility to be President of the United States. It was a good week for prophecy after a group of Peruvian shamans giving their annual New Year's predictions, said 2026 would see Trump overthrow Venezuela's Maduro, which he did just 3 days later. Ominously for Trump, the shamans also predicted the U.S. leader would soon fall seriously ill. It was a bad week for prophecy after the arrest of a Thai man who, in his work as a street fortune teller, allegedly told a 19-year-old tourist that she would soon experience misfortune and lose a valuable possession, a prediction that came true when he stole her iPhone 13 Pro. It was a bad week for exceptionalism after a new survey revealed a sharp decrease in the percentage of Americans who believe they could, without weapons, defeat a grizzly bear in a physical confrontation. Only 2.75% of U.S. sports fans told pollsters they could outfight a grizzly, a significant drop from 6% in 2021. It was a bad week for parenting after a Maryland couple used ChatGPT to name their newborn son. Without divulging the parents' own first names, Carroll Hospital announced that the name Hudson Oakley Winkler was generated and selected using ChatGPT and wished the Winklers well in their new family traditions. Minneapolis, shot dead by ICE. A federal immigration agent shot and killed a 37-year-old mother of three in Minneapolis just a day after the Department of Homeland Security said it was deploying 2,000 officers to the city in its largest ever immigration enforcement operation. While conducting a raid in a residential neighborhood, ICE agents approached a car and a witness heard them tell the driver, Renee Nicole Good, to get out of here. Homeland Security officials claimed Good, a legal observer for anti-ICE groups, then attempted to run over officers, prompting one to fire three times in self-defense. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem called the incident domestic terrorism. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey called that account bullshit, and video of the scene shows Good trying to reverse, then drive forward, before an agent standing by the driver's side headlight opens fire. Good's mother, Donna Ganger, said her daughter was probably terrified. Phoenix, censured. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth announced that he had censured Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, a retired Navy pilot and astronaut, for his role in a video reminding service members they can refuse illegal orders. Kelly appeared in the November video with five other Democratic lawmakers who have criticized President Trump for deploying soldiers in U.S. cities and bombing alleged drug boats. "Our laws are clear," Kelly said in the video. "You can refuse illegal orders." Trump was furious. Hegseth called Kelly's remarks seditious, although he himself said something similar about illegal orders in 2016. Hegseth said the Pentagon had started disciplinary proceedings that could reduce Kelly's retirement rank and pension. Republican Senator Tom Tillis said punishing Kelly would have chilling effects on speech. Kelly vowed to fight this to show Hegseth and Trump they don't get to decide what Americans in this country get to say about their government. Washington, D.C., rewriting history. The Trump administration marked the fifth anniversary of the January 6, 2021 assault on the U.S. Capitol with a new page on the official White House website that references the attack as a peaceful protest involving mere trespassers and casting President Trump as a hero for pardoning the rioters. Democrats were the real insurrectionists for certifying Trump's 2020 election loss, according to the White House, and the Capitol Police, not the angry mob, instigated the violence. The whitewashed narrative comes after the New York Times reported that some pardoned rioters were angry at Trump for not validating their claims that the Capitol riot was all a deep state setup for which they deserve reparations. A Democratic resolution marking the anniversary was blocked in the Senate by Senators Jim Justice, Republican of West Virginia, and Tommy Tuberville, Republican of Alabama. "American patriots gathered in Washington to peacefully protest," Tuberville said. Washington, D.C., delayed release. The Justice Department admitted in a court filing that it had released less than 1% of the files in its possession related to the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and his convicted associate Ghislaine Maxwell, more than 2 weeks after a deadline set by Congress for unsealing all the documents. In an update to a New York federal judge, Attorney General Pam Bondi said the Trump administration had released 12,285 documents, totaling 125,575 pages, but more than 2 million remained in various phases of review by hundreds of lawyers and FBI analysts. Bondi said the sheer volume of material and the need to protect victims' privacy was forcing the department to make rolling releases. Epstein survivors criticized the government for the slow pace and for making extreme redactions. Early dumps included mentions of President Trump, including several flights he made on Epstein's jet. "What are they trying to hide?" Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, asked in a post on X. Atlanta, vaccines nixed. The Trump administration slashed the number of vaccines recommended for children to 11 shots, down from 17, in the sharpest public health shift yet under Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who has long claimed without evidence that such shots harm children. The Centers for Disease Control said it was no longer recommending vaccinating all children for rotavirus, COVID, influenza, hepatitis A, hepatitis B, and meningococcal disease, which causes meningitis and can kill within hours. States mandate vaccinations but rely on federal guidance. Kennedy said the change respects families and rebuilds trust in public health. Pediatricians, immunologists, and other medical experts said the new guidance would sow more confusion and distrust of vaccines at a time when immunization rates are falling and cases of flu and measles are soaring among children. The administration said Dr. Paul Offit of Children's Hospital of Philadelphia is putting children in harm's way. Mexico City supporting Venezuela. Protesters across Mexico railed against the U.S. for the raid that abducted Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, calling it a shameless assault on a sovereign nation. Some demonstrators chanted, "Yankees out," and "We are Venezuela." Some in Mexico feared that the Venezuelan assault was partly intended to cut off Venezuelan oil supplies to Cuba, and that President Trump will therefore also seek to punish Mexico, which last year overtook Venezuela as Cuba's main supplier of oil. Last month, President Claudia Sheinbaum said her country would maintain its relationship with Cuba in defiance of U.S. requests. Well, she called for all countries to respect the UN Charter that prohibits invasions. "We categorically reject intervention in the internal matters of other countries," Sheinbaum said. Caracas, courting Trump. Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado told Fox News' Sean Hannity that she wanted to share her Nobel Peace Prize with President Trump to thank him for toppling Nicolas Maduro. "The Venezuelan people, because this is a prize for the Venezuelan people, want to give it to him and share it with him," Machado said from an undisclosed location. Having relied partly on U.S. assistance to sneak out of Venezuela last month to collect the Nobel in Norway, she was reportedly shocked to discover that the U.S. did not intend to install her opposition group in Maduro's place. She said she rejected the authority of Delcy Rodriguez, the interim president backed by Trump, and would return to Venezuela as soon as possible to help the opposition win a fair election. Off the coast of Iceland, tanker seized. The U.S. seized a Russian-flagged oil tanker south of Iceland after chasing it across the Atlantic for 2 weeks in a rare great power standoff at sea. The Coast Guard first tried to board the empty tanker, then known as the Guyanese-flagged Bella One, in the Caribbean as it headed toward Venezuela in violation of a U.S. blockade. The vessel fled, registered under Russia's flag, and renamed itself Marinera. Russia dispatched a submarine to escort it to a Russian port and said it was monitoring the anomalous situation. The U.S. said it had a warrant to seize the ship because it had transported Iranian oil. Meanwhile, the U.S. also intercepted the supertanker M. Sophia in the Caribbean, saying it was shipping Venezuelan oil to China. Sidon, Lebanon, Israeli strikes. Israel bombed what it said were Hezbollah sites in southern Lebanon just as Lebanon reached its self-imposed deadline to disarm the Iran-backed militia. Lebanese President Joseph Aoun said the army had successfully implemented its plan to extend its authority in Hezbollah's stronghold on the Israeli border. But Israel said Beirut hadn't done enough to fulfill its promise under a November 2024 ceasefire to disarm Hezbollah, which launched a wave of rockets at the Jewish state after Hamas attacked Israel on October 7, 2023. Over nearly 14 months of fighting, Israel killed thousands of Hezbollah's more than 50,000 fighters, including several top leaders, and destroyed some 70% of its weapons. Still, the group is believed to retain tens of thousands of rockets and missiles it could fire into Israel. Since the ceasefire was reached, Israel has violated the agreement thousands of times, the UN said. People. O'Donnell's unstoppable urge. "Rosie O'Donnell just can't help herself," said Jeff Edgers in The Washington Post. The comedian and talk show host has a compulsion to aid strangers in peril, a mothering urge that she traces back to age 10 when her own mother died. It was that urge that led O'Donnell to blast Donald Trump on The View in 2006 as a snake oil salesman for his showy, drawn-out deliberations over whether to uncrown a scandal hit Miss USA. It was the start of a feud that raged through Trump's first presidential term, an experience she had no desire to relive. So in early 2025, O'Donnell fled to Ireland with her family, fearing what life under a second Trump administration might look like for a lesbian with five adopted children. People said, "Why didn't you go to Italy or France?" "Because I'm Irish, so I went to Ireland." But she hasn't been able to escape Trump, who in July threatened to revoke her U.S. citizenship, and whom she posts online about upwards of a dozen times a day. And her impulse to help remains as strong as ever. In her short time in Ireland, she's already performed the Heimlich on an elderly woman who was choking on steak in a restaurant. "And while I was panicking," O'Donnell says, "she sat down and ate the remaining steak." Why everyone hates Chase. "Chevy Chase has few fans in the entertainment business," said Nicole Sperling in the New York Times. The famously abrasive 82-year-old comedian and actor is so unpopular that he was excluded from Saturday Night Live's 50th anniversary special last year, despite being the show's first Weekend Update anchor in 1975. Director John Carpenter said his experience working with Chase on a 1992 movie made him want to quit Hollywood. And in 2014, Chase was written off his last major job, the NBC comedy Community, after clashing repeatedly with the showrunner and using the N-word on set while fuming in regard to his character's bigotry. "Why does he constantly rub people the wrong way? Maybe they thought I was full of myself," he says, but he also suspects people don't really like a tall, handsome, funny guy. He accepts that other tall and handsome actors manage to be liked, but they aren't as handsome. "It's like John Hamm. I met him at an airport. I spoke with him almost as a fan, and by the end of our talk, he got up and left. I've got to get my plane. No hug, no shaking hands, and I'm thinking, what have I done wrong in my life?" But he doesn't blame himself for the state of his career. "We go up and down and up and down. You make mistakes. You don't make so many mistakes. And then you get to where I am now, where I don't think any of that matters." Will Smith is being sued for sexual harassment and willful termination by a violinist who accuses the rapper and actor of grooming him. In a lawsuit filed last week, Brian King Joseph, 35, said that while working on a Smith album in early 2025, the Gettin' Jiggy With It star told him they had a special connection. Joseph joined Smith, 57, for a March concert in Las Vegas and went to his hotel room one evening to find someone had unlawfully entered and left behind wipes, HIV medication, and a note that read, "Brian, I'll be back no later, 5:30. Us, drawn heart, stone F." Fearing the intruder would return, Joseph said he reported the break-in to hotel security and Smith's team. In response, the complaint alleges, a Smith representative blamed Joseph for the incident and fired him. An attorney for Smith calls Joseph's claims false, baseless, and reckless. George Clooney hit back at Donald Trump last week after the president mocked the Democrats' decision to obtain French citizenship. The 64-year-old Oscar winner, his wife, human rights lawyer Amal Alamuddin Clooney, and their two children have lived on an 18th-century estate in Provence since 2021. Although Clooney admits he struggles with the French language, the family was able to obtain citizenship last month just before France tightened fluency requirements for newcomers. Posting online, Trump said it was good news that two of the worst political prognosticators of all time had made their home overseas. Clooney responded with a reference to the midterm elections. "I totally agree with the current president. We have to make America great again. We'll start in November." The Kennedy family gathered in New York for the funeral of Tatiana Schlossberg, but without her cousin, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who was reportedly barred from the service. A source told reporter Rob Shooter that only immediate family and close friends of Schlossberg, who died of cancer at 35, were invited. RFK Jr. was intentionally excluded so Schlossberg's two young children could manage their grief without extra public scrutiny or controversy. Schlossberg, a journalist and granddaughter of President John F. Kennedy, wrote about her cancer in a New Yorker essay last year, in which she criticized RFK Jr. for cutting medical research funding and attacking vaccines, decisions that will endanger millions of cancer survivors, small children, and the elderly. Giving up the booze. Americans are drinking less than ever, and a growing share are teetotalers. What's behind the trend? What do the numbers show? That the U.S. is losing its taste for the hard stuff. In a recent Gallup survey, 54% of American adults said they consumed alcohol, the lowest level since the pollster began tracking drinking behavior in 1939. The share of drinkers has dropped steadily and sharply since 2022, when 67% admitted they at least occasionally imbibed beer, wine, or spirits, and those that do still drink are knocking back far less. Pure alcohol consumption per person fell 3% in 2024, the biggest drop since the Prohibition era a century ago, according to the research firm Bernstein. While Gen Z often grabs headlines for its sober, curious lifestyle, only 50% of Americans age 18 to 34 say they drink, drinking is down across all generations, with the share of active drinkers among 35 to 54-year-olds dropping 10 percentage points since 2023 to 56%, and 5 points among those 55 and over also to 56%. And those numbers could keep falling. 40% of adults told pollster Ipsos that their New Year's resolution for 2026 was to drink less alcohol. Why are people turning away? It's partly an aftershock of the COVID era. The stress, isolation, and boredom of the pandemic led Americans to ramp up their drinking, especially at home. Beer, wine, and liquor store sales spiked by about $42 billion from March to September 2020, a 20% increase over the same period in 2019. And the share of Americans who reported consuming alcohol at levels defined as heavy drinking, at least 15 drinks a week for men and 8 for women, went from 5.1% in 2018 to 6.1% in 2020 and 6.3% in 2022. After those years of excess, it's understandable that many people wanted to get sober or curb their drinking, said Malcolm Purinton, a beer historian at Northeastern University. Pendulums do swing back and forth, he said, but a growing awareness of alcohol's health risks is also causing Americans to shun booze. What's happening? Experts say alcohol is going through a tobacco moment, a reference to the 1970s tipping point when the public became aware of smoking's links to cancer and cigarette sales started to plummet. A decade or so ago, there was this perception that a glass of red wine with dinner every night might actually help you live longer, said addiction specialist Dr. Scott Hadland. But in recent years, research has revealed the dangers of even moderate drinking. In early 2025, then Surgeon General Vivek Murthy issued a landmark advisory warning that no level of alcohol consumption is safe, noting that women who have just one drink a day have a 19% risk of developing an alcohol-related cancer, and that men who do the same have an 11% risk. Such warnings seem to be resonating. For the first time, a majority of Americans, 53%, now say having one or more drinks a day is unhealthy, according to Gallup. are other factors at play? There's some evidence that GLP-1 weight loss drugs such as Ozempic or Wegovy, which about 1 in 8 adults now take, may stifle the desire to drink. But for Gen Z, social factors are likely the biggest driver. Younger people who saw their parents pound drinks during the pandemic might be embracing sobriety as a way to rebel, said Purinton. They're expressing their individuality by saying, I'm not to be inebriated. I'm going to have control because you all didn't. The fear of being photographed drunk and shamed on social media is also a powerful deterrent. But Atsushi Katsuki, CEO of Japanese brewer Asahi, believes the biggest reason for the drop in drinking among young people is that they socialize less in person. Gaming, video streaming, and social media, he said, are eating into alcohol's share of fun, enjoyment, and happiness. Is the alcohol industry hurting? It's being battered not only by the drop in drinking, but also by consumers' economic worries and the shockwaves of President Trump's tariffs. As of October, shares of the world's top listed beer, wine, and spirits makers has lost a combined $830 billion in just over 4 years, a total loss in market value of nearly 50%. Jim Beam, America's largest bourbon maker, announced last month it will halt production at its flagship Kentucky facility for 1 year. And it's not just the giants who are struggling. In 2024 and 2025, there were more closures than openings of small breweries, a stark reversal for the two-decade-old craft beer boom. Winemakers face similar troubles. John Belletto, owner of Belletto Vineyards in Sonoma, California, said he expects his 2025 losses to hit $3 million and that 30% of his grapes went unsold last year for the first time in a quarter century. Few industry insiders expect a turnaround anytime soon. Instead, they are looking to adapt. How are they doing that? By embracing alcohol-free beer, wine, and mocktails. Annual sales of non-alcoholic, NA, beverages hit $1 billion in 2025, with NA beer sales rocketing by 22% from 2023 to 2024. Drinks giants are especially focused on crafting high-quality NA versions of their biggest brews, a tricky scientific task because ethanol is key to any beer's taste. UK-based Diageo has invested more than $70 million in Guinness Zero production since the alcohol-free stout launched globally in 2021. The NA beer made up more than half of the Guinness brand's growth in the U.S. in 2024. Other firms are selling functional drinks infused with supposedly mood-altering CBD oil, mushrooms, or botanicals. But analysts don't know if consumers will embrace such options en masse, and some speculate that Americans may eventually rediscover their taste for alcohol. Andrew Goen, head of research for Bell Asset Management, said this uncertainty is why his investment firm is avoiding the alcohol sector for now. This industry's been around for 7,000 years, he said, but a lot can change. Best columns of the U.S. The asterisk in the court's guard ruling. The Supreme Court has finally handed President Trump a defeat, but with a dangerous loophole, said Kim Whaley in the Bulwark. Trump announced an end to National Guard deployments in Chicago, Los Angeles, and Portland, Oregon, after the High Court ruled that he lacks the authority to co-opt National Guard troops and thrust them in American cities basically just because he feels like it. The 6-3 decision constituted a rare rebuke of the president, but didn't mistake it for a signal that a subset of the court's right-wing justices has had a change of heart about the Mad King. Conservative Justice Bert Kavanaugh wrote a concurring opinion noting that while the Posse Comitatus Act forbids the use of the military on U.S. soil, another law, the Insurrection Act, provides an exception. If the president identifies a rebellion or a conspiracy that police can't put down, then he can deploy the army in the streets. Under the unitary executive theory embraced by all six court conservatives, the president would presumably have the sole authority to decide an insurrection was underway. So, despite this setback, don't expect Trump to give up on deploying troops into American cities. Obituaries. The bombshell who embodied the new France, Brigitte Bardot, 1934 to 2025. Brigitte Bardot was more than just a screen sex kitten. With her tousled blonde hair and signature pout, the French actress personified her country's newfound sexual and social liberation through the 50s and 60s, and God Created Woman, 1956, in which Bardot played a teenager exulting in her sensuality, shocked censors, but became the highest-grossing foreign film of its day and launched a global obsession with French cinema. Simone de Beauvoir proclaimed the actress the most liberated woman in post-war France, and Charles de Gaulle chose her as the model of a new sculpture of Marianne, the symbol of the French Republic. But to Bardot, who would retire at 39 and later become known for animal rights activism and anti-Muslim bigotry, her heyday felt like anything but freedom. "My life is like a big prison," she said in 1960. "A pleasant one, but it's a prison all the same." Born Brigitte Anne-Marie Bardot into a very strict, proper, and prosperous Catholic family in bourgeois Paris, she was an aspiring ballerina, winning admission to the Paris Conservatory at 13, said the Washington Post. 2 years later, she'd been hired as a fashion model and quickly caught the eye of aspiring director Roger Vadim, who became her Svengali, and once she turned 18, her husband. He was 24. Despite not speaking English, Bardot landed her first lead role as a temptress in a 1955 British comedy called Doctor at Sea. After the breakthrough success of And God Created Woman, in which she sunbathes nude, she was generally cast as a sexpot, said The Hollywood Reporter. But at least two fiery performances proved her range. The Truth, 1960, a riveting courtroom drama, and Jean-Luc Godard's Contempt, 1963, now considered to be a new wave classic. Bardot suffered through bouts of suicidal depression and the constant wild harassment of the paparazzi, said The Guardian. She quit acting in 1973, and on the grounds of her Saint-Tropez villa, she amassed dozens of rescue animals as she campaigned for animal welfare. Her repulsion at halal methods of slaughter led her to condemn the Islamization of France by cruel and barbaric invaders, and she was convicted 6 times of inciting racial hatred. She eventually married a bigwig in the far-right National Front Party. In her final years, Bardot confessed to disliking all people, not just Muslims. "Humans have hurt me deeply," she wrote in a 2018 memoir. "It is only with animals, with nature, that I found peace." The Senate maverick who made Native history, Ben Nighthorse Campbell, 1933 to 2025. Ben Nighthorse Campbell spurned the conventions of Washington. The two-term U.S. Senator from Colorado, one of just 4 Native Americans ever to serve in the Senate, hadn't planned to enter politics. But during a flight delay in 1982, he stopped by a Democratic Party gathering in Durango and found himself volunteering to run for state legislature. 4 years later, he elected to Congress, and after 3 terms there, he entered the Senate in 1993. Campbell made an unusual politician, usually decked out in buckskin, silver jewelry, and bolo ties, and once sporting a Cheyenne feathered headdress on the Senate floor. Socially liberal but fiscally conservative, he defected to the Republican Party after the Democrats refused to pass a balanced budget amendment. His proudest accomplishment was helping create the National Museum of the American Indian. It is a monument, he said, to the millions of Native people who died of sickness, slavery, starvation, and war. Born Benny Marshall Campbell in Auburn, California, he spent part of his childhood in an orphanage, said the Washington Post. His father, a Cheyenne Indian, was often away on drinking sprees while his mother, a Portuguese immigrant, suffered from bouts of tuberculosis. Having learned judo while working on farms with Japanese migrants, he competed for his college team after serving in the Korean War and then moved to Japan to train, eventually making the U.S. Olympic squad. Campbell grew up knowing little of his native heritage, but after he had children, he enrolled in the tribe, learning to make jewelry and train horses on his Colorado ranch. As a politician, he was irreverent, blunt, and independent, said the New York Times. He built a coalition of unions, women, and Hispanic voters, but angered environmentalists by siding with the mining and logging industries. The first Native American to chair the Indian Affairs Committee, he passed the most bills of any member of the 106th Congress. Even after becoming a Republican in 1995, he continued to disregard party lines, supporting both gun rights and abortion rights, said the Durango Herald. A third term seemed guaranteed, but Campbell retired in 2005 after a health scare. Still, he continued to push for Native involvement in politics. Indian tribes and their members, he said, need to get engaged in the political process. The jockey who battled sexism to race in the Kentucky Derby, Diane Crump, 1948 to 2026. Diane Crump didn't think she'd be the first female jockey to race at a major U.S. track. A lawsuit had finally allowed women to get jockeys' licenses in 1968, when many still considered women too weak to handle a thoroughbred galloping 40 miles an hour, and two other women got theirs first. But injuries and threats of boycotts kept those two from competing, and in 1969, Crump ran her breakthrough race. Security guards had to escort the 20-year-old to the stalls as spectators booed and yelled that she should go back to the kitchen. Just a year later, Crump became the first woman to ride in the Kentucky Derby. When asked if she was nervous about competing against elite jockeys, she showed her trademark confidence. "I never worry when I ride." This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.